With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Back with me today is Michael Bryant. Michael is a citizen journalist, writer, and researcher who has worked with various anti-war groups, environmental organizations, and anti-globalization organizations on a number of issues ranging from U.S. imperialism to domestic corporate crimes to the globalization of agriculture. With regard to research, he currently does research and writing work for the Health Freedom Defense Fund and research for the COVID-19 Humanity Betrayal Memory Project. His work, his writing work, can be found at offguardian.org, at Health Freedom Defense Fund, Brownstone, Lou Rockwell, Planet Waves FM, 21st Century Wire, and other places. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me again today. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me on, Jesse.
Absolutely. So I want to continue the discussion you and I had last time about what happened in New York in early 2020. We talked last time about the essentially state-sanctioned murder that was occurring primarily in hospitals, but also in care homes, and how this was necessary to create the perception that a so-called pandemic was occurring and was being driven by a supposedly new and novel virus that caused a supposedly new and novel disease. And we got into a lot of details with regard to that, but one of the things we didn't touch on, which I'd like to touch on now, is the years leading up to that, and particularly the hospital closures that occurred in the years leading up to that, because there was a concerted effort, as documented in an article by The Independent, and that's I-N-D-Y, independent.org, which is or was, I'm not sure if it's still in publication, a free newspaper that was available in New York. I remember I used to pick it up many times when I lived there. But there was an article in an April 2014 edition of The Independent called NYC's Vanishing Hospitals. And it starts as such: New York City hospitals are dying out. They take up whole blocks, sometimes more, in a city where every square foot has a price tag. Space is limited, and condos for a select wealthy few are more profitable than treatment centers whose emergency room doors are open to everyone. 15 New York City hospitals have closed down since 2003. In the most high profile of the recent shutdowns, St. Vincent's Catholic Medical Center was demolished in 2012. Where the hospital stood for more than a century and a half on 12th Street and 7th Avenue in the West Village, developers at Rudin Management Company and Global Holdings have replaced inpatient care units with terraced two-bedroom apartments. The new site also now contains a private garden, underground parking, a 25-meter-long swimming pool, and a golf simulator. Three blocks north, where St. Vincent's operated a cancer treatment facility, another development has sprung up. And later on in the same article, it talks about how in February of 2014, New York State received $8 billion in Medicaid funds from the federal government. Governor Cuomo initially hailed the assistance as, quote, the biggest step forward towards a positive conclusion for our communities, particularly in Brooklyn, that have suffered from diminishing healthcare services, unquote. But in another letdown for those struggling to keep LICH, which is low-income communities, I believe, I'm not sure what the H stands for, I'll look that up, and other community hospitals open, I think it's low-income community hospitals and other community hospitals open, none of those funds will be put toward bailout. Funds will go toward Medicaid redesign initiatives that will reduce the number of hospital beds in favor of less costly inpatient services. And Cuomo went on to say, quote, what does, will it mean some hospital beds are reduced? Yes, because that is the point of the exercise. You will have a decrease in beds, unquote. And lastly, the article wraps up by stating that for every 500 Brooklynites, there is one hospital bed. For residents of Manhattan, there are three. Now, this was back in 2014, and I don't think we would be wrong to say that it's gotten worse since then. And this was a deliberate effort, it seems, to reduce both hospitals and the existing hospitals, and undoubtedly in the state-sanctioned execution program we saw in many early 2020. But I'd like to get your thoughts on.
Okay, so first off, I hope this is making it through. It sounded a little choppy at the end there on your end. So yes, you're correct. It's a low-income, LICH means low-income community hospitals. Before, just a few comments on what you just spoke about. I wanted to just highlight the category of at-home deaths in New York City during spring 2020. At-home death, the at-home excess mortality increase was 800% during that time. That exceeded even what we were seeing in the nursing homes. It wasn't as high as what was happening in the hospitals. However, we were all led to believe the story that individuals were being transferred into nursing homes and were then seeding infections, as the narrative goes, in those nursing homes, and then the individuals in the nursing homes were dying there. This isn't the case. There were individuals dying at higher rates in the nursing homes. However, what we were seeing was more that individuals were being transferred into hospitals from various places, and we really aren't 100% clear on all the data. We do know many of them were coming from nursing homes. There seems to be an indication that more individuals were also coming from public assisted public housing. Okay, so the at-home deaths now were caused, and I think we touched upon this in the last interview, the at-home deaths were caused almost exclusively by those who were in early stages of cardiac arrest that were afraid, they were made to be afraid to go into the hospitals, so they died of a heart attack at home, where if they had early treatment, they would have survived, quite a few of them. So I believe we covered that, and I just wanted to make sure we're aware of that third category, in that was a large number, and we do need more investigations on all of this to pinpoint who exactly were all of these people. So, on your point to the hospital, I think in the larger picture. Now, that article was in 2014. At the same time, we're seeing the same situation throughout Europe. Through austerity measures, we can just see a mirror image of what was happening in New York and not just the city, out throughout New York State, as well as in other places in the United States, we'll see the exact same image of what was happening in the hospital systems. I'll call them the health management systems. In Europe, it was done through austerity, what they called austerity measures. So we have to keep in mind that right now the health management sector is the largest money spinner of the entire economy here in the United States. Of the $17 trillion GDP yearly figure for the United States, right around 22% of that is accounted for in the health management sector, which includes a lot of different things. The hospital system is one of the major items in that. So with that in mind, if they're seeing that they can turn hospital systems into greater profit centers, they're going to and shut down the ones that are making less money, and they're going to focus on the bringing more money into the ones where wealthy patients who have high lavish insurance programs, where they can reap more money from those, are involved. And that's what's done. So for example, in New York City, you'll see that for every 500 individuals, there are three hospital beds, whereas, you go over to Brooklyn and it's one. So there are essentially per capita three times the amount of hospital beds in the wealthier area of New York City than the poor area. And that's not by accident. Relating specifically to the article you cited, an individual named Sean Petty, who is a member of the New York State Nurses Association Governing Board, said it pretty straightforward and pretty accurately. He said, it's about profit. Medicaid and Medicare are being cut, forcing hospitals that cater to those patients to close. At the same time, we're seeing expanded services at hospitals that treat patients who have insurances that pay very well. And mm-hmm. So that's the game. We have these large investors. Hospitals are no longer standalone entities. They're most of them are consortiums, and they are funded through run by the large scale investors, and the administration in these hospitals are betrothed to doing what is demanded of them by these investors.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this article points out, just to get more specific with that, prestigious Manhattan-based hospital systems with ties to university medical centers like New York Presbyterian, Mount Sinai, and NYU Langone Medical Center routinely land at the top of U.S. News and World Report's honor roll of best hospitals. They can extract better reimbursement rates from private insurers who don't want to be cut out of these hospitals and risk losing some of their most affluent policyholders. Smaller outer borough hospitals lack the market power to do the same. And so what we're talking about here is the further encapsulation or forcing of hospital systems away from the standalone model, as you said, into this capitalist system, essentially treating them as businesses rather than places where healthcare is provided, and treating them as profit-making mechanisms rather than, again, places where healthcare is provided. And that can only lead to diminishing results with regard to people getting better and also people being treated appropriately when they're there for care. It becomes not how can we best treat this person, but how can we best treat this person in order to maximize the profit of the hospital or whatever the healthcare center might happen to be.
Yes, I'm not so sure there, outside of, I'll say this first, I guess, there are plenty of doctors and nurses that are interested in treating patients and do have noble intentions.
Sure.
I would say though that, they're pretty much overwhelmed by the system, the ones that are interested in providing care. And also they are mandated to observe the protocols of the system. And they know that if they don't, they'll be out on the street in short order. They'll have a board hearing, they'll get a warning, they'll have a board hearing, and then, they'll get a threat for license revocation. And if they don't adhere to the protocols, whatever they may be, then they're no longer going to be having that lucrative income. So not too many of them are going to butt heads with that system. I'd say also that the idea is overall, having said that, the idea overall really isn't to treat patients. It's as you said, it's to, the patient has become fodder for, we could make the argument it's a type of a money laundering scheme. They're just siphoning off taxpayer money into these health management systems, which then goes back to those investors that we talked about via any number of means and methodologies, whether it's pharmaceuticals that the hospitals are using, the machinery that they're using, and so on and so forth. So that the whole system has turned into, as I mentioned before, just this big money spinning machine. If you look at, if you remember the article that I wrote on Italy was having their health system, the funding of their health systems ravaged over, a period from 2010 to 2019. Once COVID kicked in, they actually started pumping tons of money back into their healthcare system. So you might think, oh, hey, that's good. We're going to get back to tending to the patients and providing more beds and providing more medical attention and so forth. But that's not what happened. All the money went into all of these various fraudulent COVID cottage industries, as I like to call them. So none of this additional funding resulted in better care for human beings. And that's the direction that things have been moving in for over a decade now in the hospital system. And that's something that we need to change too. Now, New York State, and that change is only going to come from, people taking direct control over their lives and policies. It's not going to come through any accepted political mechanism that is out there. That seems to have been tried and failed over and over again. So no sense doing the same thing. So I would want to also add that in New York State, while there have been many hospitals in the urban centers that have closed, there also have been quite a few in the rural sector. I want to say overall, since don't quote me exactly on this figure, but since 2015, it's right around 40 hospitals statewide have been shuttered.
That's a lot. It might not sound like a lot, but that's a lot. And I don't know what the capacities of those hospitals are, but you factor that in as well as the general turnover. You're talking about a lot of people who now have reduced or even severely reduced access to care because they have to travel further or they're not able to travel and therefore have to be attended to at home, which brings along with it a whole raft of expenses. I've seen this in my own family, and I've seen this in neighbors' families, people who've had to be treated at home because it was theoretically too expensive to keep going back and forth to a hospital, but I'm not sure that the expenses really balanced out in the end. And it's tempting to say that what's been done for the past decade, even well before that, in terms of closing hospitals and turning the hospital system, the patient management system, into a profit-making system, it's tempting to say that that was done as a lead up to what was rolled out in 2020. Now, I can't say that for sure, but we could speculate, but that's a whole other conversation. Nonetheless, it did provide the conditions for what happened in early 2020 in a lot of places, and in this case, particularly New York. And the protocol system was key, and the way the protocol system was and is tied to government payouts is key. And this enabled the mass slaughter that we talked about last time, because it was incentivized and also made mandatory in a way. Like you said, if you don't follow these protocols, then you're out, because this is what we have to do. And the justification for this then, as it is to this day, is this ridiculous concept known as evidence-based medicine. And Dr. Kevin Corbett has talked about this a lot, how this has utterly destroyed hospitals, the following of evidence-based medicine / protocols, which essentially turn patients into cattle, some of whom are slaughtered. So I wonder if you have anything to say about that, about the protocol evidence-based system.
Yeah, well, it's not based on evidence, I'll say that.
Right.
But it's simply a way to keep people on the menu, and you're not allowed to deviate from your menu, your very narrow menu of options that we will dictate to you. So it has eliminated problem solving in the medical field. It has eliminated doctors who, while they're treating a patient, desisting and treating them in a certain way, which they can see is not working, which is making matters even worse. So the doctors will not have the ability to use their own senses, their own wherewithal. It eliminates critical thinking. It eliminates, to my mind, it eliminates the capacity for the doctor to be learning medicine. They can't, as they're gaining more and more experience trying different things at different times for different individuals, that's how they learn how to practice medicine in a world where they're really treating the patient as an individual. And here it's basically a corporation that's telling them, here's the menu of options, select from here. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that this is all being watched in real time. It's not as if at the end of the day or the next day, the administrator says, hey, you know what? I heard from one of the nurses you did X, Y, or Z. No, they're actually looking at this in real time. Okay. So, you know, for example, the coding for how you would handle COVID, in relation to any sort of medical procedures, it was loaded into computer software, and whatever the software is used to read the diagnosis then will spit out the recommended medications, and only allowed medications and procedures. So, you know, once that comes through, they used a scanner on this, and that links to the meds that is going to be noted that you is you being used for the patient. That then throws a code out, and that lets the administration know that the doctor or nurse did X, Y, or Z. So all of this is being tracked in real time. And,
right. You
know, the whole healthcare community, they've gotten used to this corporate environment. You know, nowadays, by the time you're well into this, you're pretty well trained to know this is how you're going to operate. You know, even if you may have started as an idealist and may still be. But like I said, it's very difficult. Takes a very special person to go up against this Leviathan, you know. So, you know, the coding then is determined by who exactly.
Right.
Who decides it.
That's such a crucial point, because while we are talking about a machine, well, a machine system spitting out a protocol, that protocol is programmed by somebody. And the real-time observation that you just brought up is key too, because that means that doctors, nurses, and the like were seeing what their protocols were doing to patients, that they were killing patients. And instead of adjusting the protocols accordingly, they continued with them. And this is where we have to start to question intent and if people, and I think, yes, people were intentionally murdered. I think there's plenty of empirical evidence for that. And then how many? And not just in early 2020 in New York, but around the world at that time. And how much of this is still going on now? Because to the best of my knowledge, this hasn't changed. And when you look at the amount of money that's been paid out for this to hospitals, I'm looking here at a document on the CMS website, Medicare Accelerated and Advanced Payments Program, COVID-19 Public Health Emergency Payment Data. This is the most recent document I can find, and it says the data below reflects payments made through and including December 9, 2020. The total at that time was $107,291,936,099. Now, that was over 2 years ago. That's an extraordinary amount of money paid out to hospitals. And ostensibly, the hospitals have to pay back some or all of that money under very generous conditions. But as you said, we're talking about massive money laundering here and the incentivizing of people to follow murderous protocols.
Yes, I'll put just a fine point on some of those figures. Now, let's go back to New York City, for example. Here we have the hospitals went from, you know, we're hearing the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed, and so on and so forth. And, you know, anyone who's spent even a reasonable amount of effort looking into this knows that wasn't the case. The data was, this is New York City. They went from, I have the exact numbers, but don't quote me as I'm saying him here today on these being precise. It's right around here. They went from right around 86% in the 3 month billing period of May, April, June in 2019, down to right around 52% in that same time frame in 2020. If you're a hospital and you're operating at 52% capacity, we can even up that to 65% capacity, you're going under, you're going broke. You need to have 80 to 90% just to break even, depending on the hospital. So here we are during this time, The hospitals are literally being emptied out, not being overwhelmed. You are now an administrator who is going to be under tremendous pressure to make up for those financial losses. You are most fortunate. You have the CARES Act, which is going to allow you to do this and then some. So you are going to be both, as you mentioned, incentivized, and as well, you have the protocols that are mandated. So you have an easy excuse there. Not only that, you now have an opportunity to make the kind of money that your hospital has never made before. So for example, as you know, I'm involved with this group, the COVID-19 Humanity Betrayal Project. And through the discussions that we have, we get the firsthand information on the nitty-gritty details of what was happening in the hospital, including the hospital billing records.
Yes. And let me just say that people can find the COVID-19 Humanity Betrayal Memory Project at chbmp.org. I'm looking at it right now. It's a heartbreaking site, and there's a bunch I'd like to ask you about this, but please continue.
Yes. So I won't say any names in this discussion. If individuals are interested in looking at the details and seeing, you know, putting a face to the story, please go to the case files section of that site. And there are videos there. You can see it. You don't have to listen to me talk about it or listen to a reporter talk about it. The person will tell you the story at length and you'll get the exact details of it. So in any case, one individual, her husband was given Tocilizumab, okay, a medication while on a ventilator. That one dose.
So that's that's a monoclonal antibody.
Yeah. The one dose is $26,878.80. Next individual, okay, her husband got the same drug. On her itemized hospital bill, it was $75,000 for one dose. This individual survived. He was in the ICU for 33 days. Okay. And his bill ended up being $1 million, just under $1 million, not including the long-term hospital, rehab hospital, home health care, and outpatient billings. Once those were tabulated, it came up to almost $2 million. Okay. That's just, and you know, these aren't isolated stories. It's the same one after the next. You know, it's a, you know, here's another individual where she, the bill that she has records for her husband who did not make it, was $1.4 million. So there's about 700 different stories currently listed on the site, and you can go and get the firsthand information, and the individuals have all the records. So it's there for any and all intrepid reporters to pick up and report. So people can mm-hmm. know what was happening, right? And this was everywhere. It was happening all over the place.
Yes, as I can see right in front of me, these people were from all over the country, and some of them thankfully survived to tell their story, but most of them did not. But they were from all over the country, and what stands out to me immediately is the age demographic. So 55, 79, 65, 67, 57, 81, 68, 57, 84, 72, 61, 53. There are people who are younger than that included in this research, but that is that's the pension age, right? That's around the retirement, the pension age. And these people were given intentionally drugs like the one you just cited, a monoclonal antibody, which is a poison, just like all of these other injections. They were given remdesivir. They were given cocktails, including midazolam and morphine and sometimes other benzodiazepines. And it was known full well what these would do to people. And they were given them intentionally, and it was to intentionally take them out because there would be a payment for taking them out. And also that would make room for the next person to come in, to be taken out, to become a profit creator for the hospital, or a money-making creator, at least for the hospital. And what this also served to do, whether the doctors or and nurses were aware of it or not, was to take out people of this age, which undoubtedly reduced the burden on what is a non-negotiable government debt in terms of Social Security payments, for example, and similar payments. Ostensibly, that's non-negotiable and is a huge amount of money. But if that can be reduced to ease the debt burden on the government balance sheets, then have no illusions. That's something that governments all over the world will go for. And where the orders to do that came from, I can only speculate, but that's what we're talking about here, especially if we're looking at the COVID-19 operation as driven by the international monetary and financial system, which is what you and I talked about in the very first conversation we had.
Yes, you know, like as I mentioned, you know, people really need to go to see these case files, and to really understand it. If you and I were to just transcribe one of the stories in the case files, and then we were going to go out into the public, and we were going to describe it to people, we got a collection of people down in the commons or in some town square, and said, you have to sit here and listen to this for 45 minutes. They wouldn't believe it. They couldn't believe it. And it's important to know that this wasn't also in the case files. There's, I think, around 700 of them right now. The reason there's only 700 of them is it takes a long while to get the video recordings put together, and there's not enough volunteers to expedite that. So there are a lot of people in waiting. And then there are a lot of people out there who want to do it, but they're just not ready to quite yet. There are an even greater number of people who just aren't even aware that this potential exists for them. There's another large number of people who don't want to talk about it. They don't, you know, they want to understandably, you know, put this painful episode in the closet somewhere. So this, the stories are striking. They are similar from Alaska to Florida. They all entail the same amount of corruption. There is a lot of malevolence in there from nurses and doctors, you'll see. And it's hard for people to comprehend it. This is the story. This, even more than the vaccine injuries, is the story to tell people what happened in spring 2020, in through the summer, through the fall. It is still happening. What happened in the hospitals will tell people, wow, this was all a fraud. They were murdering people. They were murdering people mm-hmm. in large numbers. Just one quick example of this individual. Her husband was given 14 baricitinib pills with probenecid, okay? And these were combined. These were given in combination to her husband. And it's in the pharmaceutical literature that these two should never be given together. And when probenecid is given, it has to be given with food and water. They starved him and they killed him.
Yes, that's another thing too, that it wasn't just the administration of these poisons. It was starving patients. It was dehydrating patients. It was not turning them in their beds properly so they would develop bed sores. It was basically leaving them to die while expediting their deaths with the administration of these lethal poisons.
Yeah, these were, again, you go look at the cases, you'll get the straight from the horse's mouth, how these were active decisions. These weren't just mistakes. These were individuals who were fully aware of what was happening. There's one interesting story where an individual was really trying to prevent her husband from being put on a ventilator. And the attending, one of the attending nurses, as well as a doctor, it wasn't the initial attending doctor, recognized that this individual was unvaccinated, and they were really pressuring to get him vaccinated. They were getting money for everything, okay? And so the wife refused it, the husband refused it. And there were two other nurses that privately told this individual to basically stay strong. We know that they are going to try to get him on a ventilator and that's going to be lethal. Okay. And we're praying for you. So these two nurses openly admitted it to her. Okay. She asked that these two nurses go public with this. They wouldn't. Okay. Cause they knew then that they were risking their livelihoods if they did so. Mm-hmm. And they did confide in this individual. And so you say, okay, well, that's just one story. That's an anecdote. These kind of things, again, these kind of things were happening everywhere. There's just one story after the next like this. Okay. Yes. And again, you know, this is the story. Those, and all of them then are getting labeled as COVID deaths. Okay.
Right.
So you got to keep that in mind. At the end of the day, these individuals who are getting killed by ventilators, remdesivir, midazolam, so on and so forth. Then at the end of the day, are getting diagnosed with COVID. Then the hospitals get an additional 20% more. Okay, tacked right onto all this. So everything was the skids were greased for all of this to happen. As I mentioned, who ordered all this code red? Who did it? You mentioned it as well in a way. You're like, who wrote these policies? These policies didn't just pop out of the, pop out of the springtime soil in, March, April, 2020. These had to have been designed in advance somewhere. I'm not saying they were designed to say, hey, let's just go ahead and try to kill all these pensioners. We could speculate on that. It's a valid question, certainly. But I'm quite certain these were designed to turn these hospitals into massive profit centers. If you go back and you look at the financial records, 2017, 2018, 2019 of these hospitals, they're all bleeding. Okay. So your investors and you're seeing, your big cash cow is dying out there. Okay. So here's a way to bring more feed into the animals here. We're going to crank it up through the invention of this entire phony pandemic. I mean, pandemics are mammoth investment opportunities, pandemic in quotes.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And had this been, and I'm not saying there weren't people pointing at this and investigating it when it was happening, there certainly were, but had it been examined more, we very likely might not be dealing with the COVID-19 injections today. We might not be dealing with the slaughter caused by those. And I've said injections for a long time. I'm starting to think that I should just call them vaccines, because all vaccines are poisons, and these are just another iteration of that type of poison. But that's another discussion. But this, as I said in the beginning of this conversation, this industrial scale medical murder set the stage for everything that followed. And very few people pointed at it then, and very few people are pointing at it now. Now it's all about, we have to stop the shots, which I do not disagree with on any level, but that's not the only action item, and that is not going to solve the foundational problem we're dealing with here. And just before I get further into that and ask for your thoughts, I want to point out that the death protocol in hospitals that we've been talking about was all throughout the US. It was happening in the UK, the midazolam murders, as they're infamously known. It's still happening. It was also happening and is still happening in Russia. In the Moscow City News Agency, published on the 10th of November, 2021, it was reported that the Minister of Health of the Russian Federation, Mikhail Murashko, announced that the drug remdesivir for the treatment of COVID-19 will be delivered to all regions of the Russian Federation. So that's being used all across Russia as well. For if it's not being used for the same reasons, it's almost certainly having the same outcomes, because that is that's a death sentence drug. If you look at the clinical trials for it, it killed most of the people in the clinical trials. It's a failed drug that was repurposed for this so-called pandemic, much like AZT was a failed drug that was repurposed for the so-called HIV/AIDS epidemic. So this is this is global in scale, not just confined to the US or the UK, the Western world. The East, if you will, is doing this too. And most likely this is happening in China. I know they use ventilators in China, which are a death sentence. So this is global in scale, what we're talking about. But right now, there is a huge section of the so-called health freedom movement that does not want to look at the fraud of virology and how it led us to where we are now. And underneath that, I would say, or in concert with that, does not want to look, or is ignorant of looking at what you and I have been talking about, the lead up to, or the setting the stage of a so-called pandemic, this industrialized medical murder. And that's highly problematic, because all of these people and groups are talking about resisting and putting an end to this, but how are you going to resist and put an end to this when you can't countenance even a discussion about the core fraud of it, which is virology, and you just don't go into what set the stage for this crime, the premeditation and the scene, if you will, that had to be set to convince the world that there was a so-called pandemic happening? I think it's highly problematic. And a lot of these people will say, well, we have to focus on the shots, and you're just being divisive and distracting by bringing this up, which to me is complete bullshit and is, I would say, a moral problem on their part, this refusal to look at both the fraud of virology and what happened in these early days, as you and I have discussed. But I'd like to get your take on that.
The red herring of divisiveness is a way for them to run away from these topics. Before going into my thoughts on that, I wanted to just add this one point is DNR, do not resuscitate orders, were changed in the United States on the very same day the CARES Act went into law. That is not a coincidence. There's a very large study out in New Jersey with a large cohort of patients which found that DNR orders were a significant predictor of mortality, a finding that persisted after adjustment for other important clinical factors. No surprise there, but again, this indicates that there was some orchestrated moves that caused these deaths. And I want to just say, if you go back and look at some of those case files and go through, many of those people went into the hospitals not too bad off. They should have survived. Okay. All right. Now on to they would have survived if they were given proper treatment, or in many cases, mm-hmm. no treatment at all. In any case, to your point there, that's it is profoundly problematic with what they're doing. The biggest problem with it, as I see it, is when they get into all of this nonsense about lab leaks, aerosolization, isolated seeds. I don't know what the most recent one is, but it's they'll come up with a new one once that's disproven. They don't provide any evidence whatsoever for any of this stuff, but is that it provides cover for what actually happened, which was the decimation of these people's lives in the hospitals. Now, why I think that's I think that's more vital than the we need to stop these vaccines, which I, like you, completely agree with. The thing about just the stopping of the vaccines is you have an a priori assumption there that the vaccines are not the proper effective tool to treat these individuals who have been infected by this microbe, and to stop this next pandemic from having such a negative impact on society. So mm-hmm. if we say, okay, that's great. Now what we have to do is look for a new tool, a different medication, maybe a different vaccine, maybe, even if we're going to use downloadable mRNAs, we're just going to change the protein and so on and so forth. And then you're off and running, and there you are again. You've completely validated this fraudulent pandemic industrial complex. The difference is once we, and this is even without getting into the discussion about viral theory, once you get into the analysis and the evidence that says, here is what happened, here is the undeniable, mountainous, voluminous evidence as to what happened, it shows without question there was no pandemic. So your entire discussion of whether this vaccine is effective or dangerous or not is irrelevant, because there was nothing for it to ever be used for in the first place. Then mm-hmm. we say, okay, what do we do now? We actually have to hold these people who committed these crimes accountable. As long as the these big health freedom advocates like Highwire and Children's Health Defense Fund are avoiding this topic, which they are. They are avoiding this. I am in contact with some of these people firsthand. I know they are avoiding it, okay? And I'm going to call them to the carpet on this. When they are doing that, they are doing a disservice. Whatever you might say about some, excellent things they've done in the past, they are doing a disservice to the public. And if the leaders of the health freedom movement aren't sticking up for the most vulnerable in society, the disabled, the poor, what exactly is their function?
Right. And a lot of people don't like to hear that. Well, that's, if you want to get to truth, if truth is your primary interest here, that has to be called out. And if you want to talk about bringing those responsible for the COVID-19 operation to justice, let's look where there's evidence. And there is voluminous evidence about what happened in early 2020 to set the stage for this entire fraud that is the COVID-19 operation. Michael, unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining me again today for this conversation. I think it's an important one and probably one that we will pick up on again, but thank you again for today.
Thank you, Jesse.
And that's it for me for today. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. Stay tuned for Joe Hoft up next here on TNT Radio.